Hello and welcome to Idaho Senator Larry Craig's Pod Chat. Today is June 6th of 2006. I'm Dan Whiting and I'm here in Washington, D.C. with Senator Craig. Subscribers to Senator Craig's biweekly newsletter, E-News, and visitors to his website were invited to ask questions that were submitted through the website. And if you'd like to submit a question for a future Pod Chat or to listen to previous episodes, please visit craig.senate.gov/podchat. So, Larry, before we get into the questions from Idahoans, last week during the Memorial Day break, you and four other senators traveled to Europe and North Africa to visit cemeteries of American soldiers. Can you talk briefly about what you saw there, why the trip was important, what you're taking home from it?
Well, Dan, as many people who visit our website know, I have the privilege of being chairman of the Veterans Affairs Committee here in the Senate. And I felt it was tremendously important, while I am chairman of Veterans Affairs, that I look at all of the sides of the veterans issues that I'm authorized to do. And one of them is in part to help fund the cemeteries and the national monuments that we have around the world honoring our fallen heroes. Of course, many of our viewers or those who come to our website remember World War I and II, and literally the tens of thousands of Americans whose lives were taken, and in those years, many of them were buried right there, and they've stayed there. We've established beautiful national cemeteries and national monuments to them at the Ardennes, at Normandy, in Tunisia and North Africa with the North African campaign. And I felt it was tremendously important to see those cemeteries, to see how they're being cared for and managed, and to honor during Veterans Day and Memorial Day our fallen heroes. So I and three other senators who are members of the Veterans Affairs Committee did just that. We have 24 cemeteries in 10 countries. We visited only 7 of those in 4 countries, in Belgium and Holland, in France, and in Tunisia, in North Africa. It was a humbling experience to see literally acres and acres of marble crosses, tens of thousands of American lives taken, all in the name of securing freedom for Europe, and bringing down, in those days, the Nazi regime of Germany. So that was part of the reason I went. One of my goals while chairman is to visit every one of these memorials or cemeteries to make sure they're being well cared for. My report to all who may be listening at this moment, they are not only well cared for, they are very well cared for. World War II cemeteries and monuments were built now over 60 years ago, and they are immaculately and beautifully cared for in honor of those who are buried there. We can be very proud of what we've done and how we continue to do it.
Are there any experiences that you had over there that you didn't expect?
Well, I had the privilege of speaking at 3 of the cemeteries, and you would be surprised, I was surprised, that these ceremonies were large and well attended. It wasn't Americans who were in attendance. It was citizens of the country of Belgium or Holland or France who attended these marvelous Memorial Day ceremonies. I walked away from the one at the Ardennes, which is a cemetery in Belgium, and those who were buried there were killed during the Battle of the Bulge. And as I was leaving, a young U.S. citizen, a girl in her, my guess is, mid-20s, walked up to me very angry and said, "Senator, you've impugned the integrity of these heroes who are buried here." And I said, "How did I do that?" "Well, you talked about the war in Iraq." And she said, "That's an illegal, immoral war, and these are heroes." And it was very frustrating to me. I said, "Well, you may not agree with the war in Iraq. Would you in 1943 have agreed with U.S. men dying here to stomp out Nazi power?" And she said, "Well, that isn't the point." And I said, "Well, it is a point that every generation of Americans have had to stand for freedom for themselves and for other people around the world throughout our history. That is simply a fact." And I said, "You certainly have the right to disagree, but I don't think that me comparing the men and women dying today in Iraq in defense of our freedom, the war on terror, and freeing Iraqis is any different than the men who fought here to free Belgium of Nazi power. So she went about her way. I went about my way. No more than 100 yards later, I was ready to get on a bus, and a young fellow from Belgium walked up to me, probably in his mid-30s. And he said, "Senator, may I have my picture taken with you?" And I said, "Oh, I would appreciate that." And we visited a little bit, and tears started rolling down his cheeks. And he said, "I want you to know that those men who are buried out there freed my grandfather, who was prisoner of the Nazis, and therefore my father lived free, and I live free." And he says, "You tell Americans we love them, because they love freedom, and they made us free." And I thought, isn't that an interesting comparison with this young U.S. citizen who certainly had the rights to say what she said? Thank goodness we have freedom of expression here. But a young man who whose grandfather was a prisoner of Nazi domination of the lowlands of Europe, and now he's free, and he accredits his freedom to the young men, mostly men in those days, who were laying there dead, who came from all parts of America to a country they had never known much about and didn't care to know much about, and gave their lives so that that young man could be free today. That's a pretty powerful statement.
It's powerful, and it's reminded the other day what Ronald Reagan used to say, that we can't stop fighting for freedom today, or else our future generations won't enjoy it.
Well, it's really very, very true, because every generation, if you look down through our history, has in one form or another had to engage in military conflict. But it's all been in the name of human freedom, not domination, not control, but quite the opposite.
So, well, on to questions from Idahoans. Not surprisingly, you received a number of questions about border security and immigration reform.
Yes.
Some of the folks asking questions include Kay from Nampa and Ron from Post Falls and Lois from Burley and George from Driggs and Diane from Wendell, so just all over the state. I think Maureen from Hazleton asked, and I quote, Would a guest worker program be beneficial to the United States? I know that's certainly been kind of the lightning rod in the immigration bill in the Senate, is the guest worker program. Can you just talk briefly about that?
Absolutely. First and foremost, a nation that does not control and secure its borders is a nation that could ultimately lose its identity or clearly be held victim by those who wish to move across the border for whatever purpose. I hope we've learned that lesson. And what our president did several weeks ago to bring the Guard in to help secure our southwestern border, I think is a very important process that we have to continue to enhance and improve. In the immigration bill that passed the Senate a week before last, some very strong border control issues in it. It's really got to be number one in the issue. But number two in the issue is a viable workforce. Americans are at full employment today, basically nationwide. It's certainly true in the state of Idaho. And yet in full employment, we have what some would argue are between 8 and 10 million illegals here. They're working too, along with those U.S. citizens who are fully employed. What does that say? It says that at any one time in our economy, we need some immigrant foreign national workers in our economy. How best to have them here? A guest worker program is probably the better way to have them here. People from foreign countries who come here to work and then go home. We used to have a good guest worker program. At least it worked well. It got a lot of criticism in the 50s, called the Obrero program. It got criticism because some of the workers were treated in inhumane ways, and probably its criticism was justifiable. But it worked. People came, they worked, they left. We traded that for what's known as an H-2A program. That's the guest worker program dominantly for agriculture today. It didn't work. It was so bureaucratic, so cumbersome, that it could only identify about 42,000 workers a year in agriculture, when agriculture needed 1.5 million. We have to have a guest worker program if we're going to sustain American agriculture. But it needs to be legal. It needs to be transparent. We probably need a guest worker program in the construction trades nowadays, in drywalling and in some of the home building trades. In other areas, we need a guest worker program, but with the option, if they want to work for it, to earn citizenship, to go through the normal processes, to fit within the quotas, because, you know, folks with PhDs degrees and high talents in engineering and all of that, pretty productive folks, wouldn't make bad citizens or good citizens. They certainly would. So it's a combination of all of those things. I don't think if we want a growth economy, if we want to continue to sustain many of our social programs and the benefits our country has, and we have to hold an economy, keep a workforce viable. Americans are having fewer children today. You're not going to grow an economy if you don't have additional workers coming in beyond those that are produced within the economy itself. But it's a balancing act. It's got to be legal. It's got to be transparent. And most importantly, the borders have to remain secured.
Great. Well, on to some other issues. As we know, back in the early days of the Clinton administration, wolves were reintroduced into Idaho. Derek is from Caldwell, Hunter, and he wants to know if there's going to be anything done with the wolves because they're decimating the deer and the elk populations. So can you talk for a moment about, I mean, there's Idaho, there's Wyoming, there's Montana, and how is all that working together to help manage these wolves?
From the very beginning, I should say, was opposed to the reintroduction of wolves because I knew they would come into an uncontrolled environment and the bureaucracy would largely ignore what ultimately happened. And that is that the wolves populated at a phenomenal rate because there was no control over their populating. And we have hundreds upon hundreds of wolves today in that three-state area. And the person who went to our website and emailed us is absolutely right. They, by all accounts, are pulling down our elk herds and our deer herds at an unprecedented rate, and they're killing domestic livestock. As you may remember, the governor of the state, Governor Kim Thorne at the time, along with myself and others, worked with the Department of Interior and got a special agreement between U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and Idaho to start managing these wolf populations a little more intensely and to take out wolves that were threatening before they killed. But that was primarily for domestic livestock herds. Pretty hard to observe a, quote, threatening wolf in a backcountry terrorizing a herd of elk. So what we truly need is delisting. We're going to put a lot of pressure on the new Secretary of Interior, a fellow by the name of Dirk Kempthorne, who's now in charge of the wolves in Idaho because they are under the direct auspices of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, which is under the Department of Interior. Now, I'm being a little facetious here, but certainly we can work very closely with now Secretary Kempthorne and with the state of Wyoming and Montana and Idaho to get the wolves delisted. Then we can get into a reasonable management control with our fish and game departments at the state level to bring these wolf populations down to a reasonable and manageable number. I don't know what the magic of that number is, but I do know that we are almost to a point of being out of control, and our deer and elk populations, along with domestic livestock, are being taken at an ever-increasing rate, and the wolf population will continue to multiply, now at an ever-precedented rate because of the sheer numbers that are there. So it's time they got delisted. It's time we got state programs in the three states that control them in a general way and bring the overall predation resulting from these wolf packs down to a hopefully a reasonable number.
Great. Well, you touched earlier in the pod chat about the war in Iraq and the war on terror. George from Pocatello is against the war, and he asks, quote, how does support for unnecessary preemptive war at costs exceeding $200 billion contribute to slicing the federal budget? And what about the more than 2,500 dead young Americans and tens of thousands of innocent Iraqis? So maybe you could touch on where do you see the war going? I mean, we all know that, to use a cliche, freedom isn't free. But, you know, how much is it going to cost? I know tonight you're meeting to finalize another supplemental appropriation for the war. And how do we have any idea how long it's going to take to inject democracy into the Middle East?
Well, I suspect that it has taken longer than any of us would have hoped it would take. At the same time, we were probably pretty naive to assume that democracy would come instantly and easily to nations that had never practiced it or populations that had never had. And yet we've persevered, and a government has stood up, and most government officials are appointed by now or elected. Two free elections have been held. Violence still is ongoing, but most of that is against Iraqis. Why? Because Iraqis are now rapidly assuming control in the military and in the police forces as U.S. military stand back even further. So I believe there's a great deal that has been gained and that will continue to be gained over the next good number of months. We already see our military talking about drawdowns of numbers of U.S. military and putting them back in garrison modes. Yes, we've spent about $200 billion in the war already. Let us remember that the terrorist attack on this nation on 9/11 cost this economy in about a six-month period $1 trillion. And it cost the world economy about $1.5 trillion. I'm not sure how you measure it or impact it, but my guess is another major hit by terrorists in this country would again impact us in a similar fashion as the one that happened on 9/11. It's my opinion that sometimes we forget that out of convenience, that there really was a reason for going and a reason for attempting worldwide to slow the war, the terrorist activities, to keep it out of this country. And to slow its overall impact on ourselves and the world economy and people around the world. So I believe there's a clear reason for doing what we did. At the same time, I want us to move out as rapidly as we can. Those are our sons and daughters over there that are at risk, and some have died. There's no question about it in the fighting that has gone on. You know, I can sit here and talk about the 300,000 or million people that Saddam Hussein killed and the millions he ran out of his country and all of that. That's really not the point any longer. The point is to look at ourselves, to look at the role we play in the world, and the role that we've got to continue to play as somebody who believes in freedom, will fight for freedom, and is the stabilizing force for freedom around the world. There is a price to be paid when we do that. The question is it worth it in the end? And I don't know that you measure it by lives, and I don't know that you measure it by dollars and cents. You look back over a period of time to see if you've been able to sustain your freedom and your access for generations to come. That's what these involvements are all about.
Well, we have time for one more question. Lynn from Pocatello is touching on the economy, and I know you mentioned earlier that we're at full employment. But Lynn wants to know if it's a possible way to look into raising the minimum wage in Idaho. It says, with the price of gas, it makes everything else like groceries and clothes cost more. So he says, hopefully things will change, but it looks like it's getting worse. So I know it's a state issue, but maybe you can touch on that.
Well, it is a state issue. There is a federal minimum wage. I have tended over time not to vote for federal minimum wages because it forces the wage base up artificially. We're at full employment in Idaho right now, which means that to find workers, you're going to have to pay higher wages. Usually wages move up in that kind of market, and what I've been told is that that's exactly what's happening. Few companies today or businesses are able to find workers at minimum wage. There's no doubt that the impact of the cost of living and certainly the fuel prices, gas prices, are very real items for those who are at or near minimum wage. I'll tell you, they're very real items for those of us who aren't. It is a tremendous hit on everybody's pocketbook to be paying upwards or near $3 a gallon for gas and other expenses in the economy. But I don't believe we'll see minimum wage passed in this Congress, and I doubt that the state will move it even higher, because the figures I'm looking at today is that about 99% of Idahoans are working several dollars above minimum wage at base, or many more, or considerably more than that, simply because of the strength of our economy and the near full employment that we are in.
Well, with that, we're out of time for the pod chat. If there's a question you'd like answered in the future, please visit Senator Craig's website at craig.senate.gov. With that, thank you for listening.